agenda. We're going to start with concluding the discussion on our site visits. We were able to talk about two of the sites that members went out to visit, and that was the Guadalupe Area Project as well as Cyber Village Academy. But we had two other sites that were visited by members of the committee, and that was the Avalon Charter School right down the road on University Avenue and Highland Park Elementary Magnet School. So what I'd like to do is just start with a discussion and a sharing of thoughts and ideas and experiences from the Highland Park Magnet School. So if I could, I'm going to call on Representative Peterson, to share with us what you learned, what you saw, what your experience was like over at Highland Park Elementary.
Well, it was a very exciting experience. It was an international baccalaureate school. And who was there with me?
Representative Wardlow was with you.
Anybody else? Anyway, it was, I think we were all impressed. It's a primary school, site-based decision-making. Lynn, what? Let me get my thoughts together here. What was impressive to you?
Representative Wardlow.
Mr. Chair, the fact that we got there with absolutely no problems. But we had Lisa with us.
And Representative Erickson did run a scouting mission the day before to make sure she had the path down straight, and she wanted me to share that. All right. Representative Wardlow.
I was impressed with the thoroughness that they had all of the standards on the walls, even with all the work that the kids had done, you know, examples of the work the kids had done to meet those standards, and how they, every class taught Spanish. Even if the teacher didn't know how to speak Spanish, they taught in Spanish a little bit. In my case, it would have been very little. And also, it reminded me of a throwback to the days when my wife, she's a third grade teacher, but when she was a K through 3 teacher a long time ago, she had to teach music. Do her own FIAD and things like that, and that's what they do in this building. The teachers all teach music, they all teach, I can't remember if they have a FIAD specialist or not, but it's a bare bones operation. They have a budget of $1.3 million. You know, Randy Moss could build 12 of those schools, you know, fund them. But I was impressed with the fact that, they have no media specialists. They all have to know their own computers. They have to, you know, become experts in that field themselves. They have to, they do have a science specialist, and that's how they get their prep time. The kids will go to the science specialist, and they get prep time that way. But the growth experience that seems to occur there is phenomenal. The kids really are learning there, and I was just impressed with the professionalism of that whole school and the parents. Lots of parent volunteers. They're just dedicated to the whole system there. And I remember some other things that I was going to talk about a week ago, but I kind of forgot them now.
And you're such a young man, Representative Wardlow. Representative Peterson.
Well, I can finish up now because now I've gotten time to think back a week. It really is a site-based decision school, and they need special training, and they have to. It's a fairly prescribed program, but yeah, as you know, they have international baccalaureate in the middle school and the high schools, but this is the first time I've seen it in a primary school. The whole school is focused on this particular way of making decisions and the curriculum. Now, the curriculum is certainly aligned with the standards, but it's project-based and very individualized, a very specific way of teaching. And all of the teachers have good professional development on site. There's a part-time released person on site to deal with helping teachers again to run the school. Now, the reason that they don't have art and music is they decided their specialist should be science and Spanish. So that was a decision at the school site. So I think it was an example of how you can have a site-based magnet program in a large public school system that's meeting the needs of a number of students. And their scores and their achievement gap is their scores are improving, the achievement gap is narrowing. I was very impressed with the school.
Representative Peterson, what was her administrative structure like?
A principal who was certainly a leader, but was the kind of leader that could delegate and shared the decisions again, worked with the staff to help make those decisions in a way that supplemented the program or implemented the program in a very positive way. And I think, you know, you really have to have a good leader when you have a school that's not only a magnet school, but works with parents, because the parents were very involved in the council, the site-based decision council. And I think that's true of all of the St. Paul schools. Pat Harvey has seen that they have the training and that there's a lot of decision-making at the sites, in all of the elementary schools at least. And as far as I know, it was just one administrator. I don't think they even had an assistant. They had the part-time, or they had the professional development person there. That's another release person, but that deals with coaching, mentoring, assisting teachers.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Daphne, would you share your experiences?
Mr. Chair, it's like being caught whispering in class. But that part rarely happens in class. I too was impressed by Highland Park. Clear commitment. To echo Representative Peterson's comments about the principal, she clearly was not just an administrator but an instructional leader, and had broad support from the teaching corps and from parents. There were representatives from the site council there who were very engaged and very active parents who'd helped build the support for the move to the IB or the pre-IB program, and were very enthusiastic about what their kids were getting in those classrooms.
Very good. Anyone else who went to Highland? And at this point, I'm going to be quiet and turn the chair over to Representative Dorn.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I apologize. I had a meeting with constituents across the highway. They all take longer than I think, but Mr. Chair, I'm more than willing, appreciative. I'll assume the gavel, maybe sometime in April, depending on which bills are up, Mr. Chair. As I understand it, was there anyone else who had something to share on Highland Park, or we'll move to the Avalon Charter School? And the first question, I wonder if the driver got you there in a timely fashion, or if he gave you the tour of most of St. Paul, and I see the chair was the driver, so I don't know if somebody wanted to start in terms of the Avalon Charter School and what they observed and impressions and thoughts they came away with. All right. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we got there without a glitch, it's only because we have a capable committee administrator who also drove and led the way. So, also, it was probably one of the simplest schools to get to, seeing as we just had to get on University and head west, mm-hmm. right, and ran right into the school. So, but my impressions of Avalon is it's also a project-based school, a project-based charter school, and I was really impressed with the passion of the educators that were working there. One of the things we talked about was, in a small school, right, the role of an educator is very different than it is in a large school, and I know that personally, having taught down in South America at a very small school, where in the 4 years I taught there, the largest class I had was 15 students, and I would typically have classes of 7 and 8, and one class was even 4. Right? And in a small school, you have to become more of a a jack of all trades, right? Dabbling in a lot of different things because you just don't have the staff to do everything. And we talked to the teachers who were there and said, is that a problem? Rather than preparing for one class a day, which those of us who have taught in larger schools know that can be difficult in and of itself, but we have teachers at Avalon who have to prepare for two or three different subjects in a day, and at the project base, they have to understand quite a bit of a lot of stuff. And one of the things I think was interesting that a teacher mentioned was that they truly could be continuous learners at Avalon because the projects are based on what the kids' interests are. And they become more of a coach and a guide helping the kids work through the project. And they said they learned so much from the kids and their interests in areas that they hadn't been part of. So that was a real interesting perspective that they shared, and I enjoyed.
Okay. Somebody else visited Avalon, Representative Nornes.
No, I was just going to add that I rode with the chair to the school, so I felt pretty confident we'd find it. These are always interesting because you have images of what schools should look like, and this somewhat resembled a warehouse. The facility was just something that they made use of what they had and made it work. It was obvious that they were doing as much as they could with as little as they had to work with. That included the furniture and the dividers and everything else that they needed to make a school functional. I guess the one thing that I thought was very interesting was each morning they gather together the students in groups, and they have, I forget what they called it, but a discussion period. And the group that I happened to be part of was talking about that particular day. They were talking about respect. But, that's kind of neat for the kids to focus on something before they really get into the school year or school day. And each of the students, I don't know if they did this just for us because we were company, but every single student participated. They had a little... what was that object? Anybody else in that group that I was with him? Or with? And they had a little toy. And they passed that toy from one, it was to give them courage or something, but they passed this toy to each of the students as it was their turn to talk. And they went completely around and everyone participated. And I remember as a student, many times in discussions, there were only a handful that ever got involved. So every student here was involved. The other thing, they talked about the compensation for the teachers. They do that kind of on a cooperative basis as far as setting up what the reimbursement, I think, and the salary schedules are. And then there are other shared responsibilities that pays additional compensation. In other words, if they take on extra responsibility, extra compensation goes with that. So they have the ability to take on extra duties if they choose to do that. And so that's how they get extra work done. Some of it includes, some of the office work, bookkeeping, that kind of thing. So it seemed to work very well. Again, everyone that was there, both students and faculty, seemed to really be committed to what they were doing. And the one other thing, I guess, we're talking about the teachers and having to do multiple tasks. I think that's the one area that runs kind of contrary to the No Child Left Behind. In rural Minnesota, many small schools, this is how they have functioned from the days of the rural schools, the one-room schoolhouses. Teachers have had multiple tasks to do, from turning on the furnace to sweeping the floor to, teaching the kids. And I think it's worked. And hopefully... in some of our districts where that's continuing to be a problem with meeting those new federal requirements, that we can probably moderate that a little bit. But so I enjoyed that 2 hours we were there. very very educational.
Okay, thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Person, is this how to say business? I would like to, it was at an elementary school or middle school or a high school?
It was a high school.
It was a high school.
Okay. I think on the list of who visited, either is anyone else who went to Avalon wish to chair? You know, Representative Severson was there, and we're just kind of sharing any observations or impressions from the visits that we took, or Representative Eakin, if you had something. You're the last of the ones who visited Avalon who are on the list who are here today. Some of the others are not here.
Yeah. Well, I was impressed too by the excitement of the teachers that were working there, and I think what's important is to keep teaching fresh for the teachers, and the fact that they do teach multiple subjects I think helps that way, and the fact that it was project based so that it wasn't just the same thing every year, and the interests of the students were taken into consideration when developing, you know, what the class should be. I've always thought that was a good way to teach, is to also take into consideration the interests of the student and let them have some ownership in what's taking place. And that's, I think, one thing that keeps the students' interest there is to give them ownership so that they have some control over what's being taught, and they can delve into matters that they have a genuine interest in. One other, I think, a positive aspect of this school is the fact that it was small. I think I've always been an advocate of smaller schools, because I represent mainly small schools in my district, and one thing I find is that there's a greater sense of community that exists in those schools, and I found that to be the case in Avalon. I think it means a lot when the teachers know all the students in the school, and the sense of community. The fact that it's small also means that students are going to interact with other students of different interests and so on, and I think that's important, so you don't have cliques developing like you would in some of the larger schools. So I was impressed by it, and feel that it's good to offer choices for students, although I do think it's also important to point out that to offer more choices means that you have more schools, more teachers, more programs, which also requires more funding and more money. And I think that's important to keep in mind as well. It's fine to talk about offering choices, but we also need to ensure that we're offering the funding necessary to make those choices real.
Representative Biston, do you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The one thing, especially with the project-based learning, you know, it really is a step out of the norm. Rather than kids going, from science class to math class to language arts to social studies, and making sure all of the I's are dotted and T's are crossed in a very structured way. Right? The project base, you have to incorporate those standards within the projects. Right? And one of the fears, I think, as you step out of the traditional and out of the norm, is that, you know, at the end of the day, are these kids getting a good education? Are they getting what they need to move on to the next level? And at Avalon, this is the fourth year in the program, so this is the first group of kids who are now have gone through from 9th grade through 12th grade, and so, you know, it's at the end of the line for a lot of these kids, and has Avalon been a plus or a minus? And it was real neat to see in the group I sat in that every single student that applied to a college or university had, all but one had already heard that they had been accepted. Right, based on their test scores and whatnot, and the one who hadn't said that she had planned to hear within a week whether or not and fully expected to be accepted. So I think that's some kind of neat. Sometimes you have to take a deep breath and trust, and they do that, and it's been successful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, if I can follow up with that. I didn't hear how many students were there in a class, and then how many teachers were dealing, or did they not divide it that way? And I guess what I'm really wondering about is, were there a number of teachers who would assist the student on that project so that the math or the science or social studies component were being addressed by someone who was, you know, perhaps, you know, more equipped to help with those areas? Were the teachers grouping themselves in terms of working on a project with students?
Great question. When they first got together, as Representative Norton has talked about, Mr. Chairman, they first get together in the morning and they have like an advisory period. And at that time, the group I was in, Representative Severson, about 15 kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about 15. And then once they break from there, well, every child is assigned an advisor, an academic coach, somebody who works through the projects with them, who helps get them connected to the knowledge and information that they need, either through the library, through colleges and universities, through experts in different fields, whatever. And that ratio was about 18 to 1, did they say?
I believe
that's what they said, was about 18 to 1, was the ratio of advisors to students.
And I think the interesting part about that as well was that some of them had the advisor for three years, so there was a relationship that had developed there. And I think in that relationship they found kind of a security, because they knew that in that relationship there was, you know, they were looking out for their best, because they had, you know, they had a personal contact with somebody that kind of saw through with the process.
Okay.
I think there were some, you know, some of the things that I noted were the teachers group was very interesting. There was one lady there who had been a corporate executive at 3M, I think, and she had retired from there and then come back, got her teaching credential, and then stepped into that. And she was very enthusiastic about the school and about the process and helping the kids. And I thought that was a very healthy aspect, coming from community, coming from the business sector, coming in and bringing those tools to the table, and really wanted to make an impact. And you could see her enthusiasm was pretty, infectious, thank you. And so the others were, you know, equally excited about it. The student diversity as well, it was interesting, because when we asked, where are y'all from, there was one student that had just heard word of mouth about it, and he or she, I can't remember which, was coming from Stillwater. And so there was a large, you know, a large draw for that particular school. Most of it was via word of mouth. And when they came, they interviewed for the school, and they really liked the whole concept. So I think you probably have that plus in this school regime, where in a public school, you know, not everybody wants to be there. So that would be another aspect to look at. I think the senior project was a great concept. In fact, when we look at higher education, you look at, you know, doing the master's thesis and your doctoral, and I think this was kind of, you know, kind of geared the kids towards that whole concept of, there's a big project at the end I need to be working with, I'm doing all the rest of this stuff, but that big project is really something that the whole community got involved with, and they would have a half hour to do that presentation for their graduation project, and spent virtually the entire year preparing for that. Math was the core curriculum. They had everybody started math the whole day, and I thought that, you know, being a math minor, physics major, it was kind of one of those things that kind of cut near and dear to my heart as a discipline, in terms of organizing your thoughts and using that that core curriculum. Is no kidding, it's important for the learning process. And then the other was the student congress. I thought was a neat concept. The ownership of the kids being able to get, you know, if they're really interested in about making a difference in the school and how the school operates, had a venue to do that, and that they had the voice in the student congress to be able to run for that, to be able to participate in that. In fact, they had one particular bill that they had passed just to get the students involved, and that was that you could not wear a hat. I mean, they just said, okay, from this day on, no hats available. And they wanted to see how the rest of the students would react to that. And so they all rose up and said, this is unconstitutional. Yeah. And so they got involved in the governmental process, which I think is great for the school itself, but it also gives the students the ownership for you know, community and for local government once they get out of that educational institution. So there were a lot of good aspects, and I really appreciate having the opportunity to go there and view it.
Okay, well, thank you all for sharing that. We're gonna move on to the next item on the agenda. Before we do, I'll officially call the meeting to order. We didn't have a quorum when we began the meeting, and we should move the minutes of February 3rd. Representative Marquardt moves the minutes of February 3rd. Any discussion? All in favor of approving the minutes, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The minutes are approved. And next, we're going to switch the agenda a bit and start with a report from the Mental Health Caucus. And I believe that would be Representative Greiling and Representative Anderson who are going to step to the table and share what they've been doing and whatever else they wish to present. And do we have a kind of an estimated time amount for each of the presenters? Okay, 10 to 15 minutes.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as the caucus leadership is coming to the table, I guess I just want to say that legislators here, we have awful busy schedules and awful busy lives during the course of the work that we do here up in St. Paul. And with all of the things we have assigned to us, I think it's important that we acknowledge the work that some legislators have taken on above and beyond what has been assigned to them, because they have an interest and a passion for whatever topic that they choose. And today we're going to hear from two of them, the Mental Health Caucus and the Early Childhood Caucus. These are legislators who have come together, who have taken it upon themselves to learn much more about an issue and work through those things. So I think it's important that we, as a committee, first acknowledge their efforts and thank them, right? And then affirm the work that they're doing by giving them a stage, a platform, an open public meeting, all right, in which they can share with us the things that they're looking at and talking about and the issues that have been raised as they move forward. Right? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. Representative Greiling or Representative Anderson? Greiling is first. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Chair Dorn and Chair Biskin, for that nice introduction. And we do have our little, we've assigned ourselves a dog and pony show, so we're going to both talk here and there. So we're very organized. And we do appreciate the chance to talk about the Mental Health Caucus to this committee. We just got started about a month ago, and we had our first meeting just a couple weeks ago. And already we have half the legislature that has joined. And the page is passing out a list of those who currently belong. We've had very good attendance at our first two meetings. And if you have an interest in a better mental health system and you haven't joined yet, then feel free to email me and we will add you to the list. We are calling those who have joined so quickly our charter members, and we're happy to have more members as well, because there's a lot of interest in this from those of us who don't serve on Health and Human Services, and that's kind of why we got started. Representative Anderson and I are both family members, and a lot of people are interested. So that's kind of how we got started, and we had an organizational meeting where we asked people who were there what are you interested in, and we came up with four meetings for this year based on the group of 42 legislators at our first meeting, and now we have 67 members, and we ended up with four meetings. Bruce is going to talk about the first one that we had Monday, the next one coming up in a couple of weeks, and then I will talk about the next two that are scheduled. So Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Representative Greiling, and members, thank you for allowing us to come before the committee and to share with you some of our concerns, some of our thoughts, some of our ideas. And as Representative Greiling has already mentioned, we have organized and have had our first meeting this past Monday evening, and plan for another three meetings to discuss certain areas. The first meeting that we had was basically just organizational to come together and decide what we wanted to talk about. In the second meeting this past Monday evening, we talked about the criminal justice system and mental illness itself as it relates to the criminal justice system. We had a special guest come in. The senators, Senator Linda Berglund and Senator Steve Dill, are co-chairs with us from the Senate, and they came in and first presented to us their proposal as far as legislation regarding the criminal justice system and how we can decriminalize individuals who have mental illness backgrounds or who are caught up in the system, and because of the way the system works and the statutes that are in place, have been unduly put into this place. And across the states and the nation, lots of finances that maybe could have been refocused in a different area. And so I'll give you a gist of what we talked about this past Monday night. The title of it was Summary of Legislation to Improve Outcomes for Prisoners with Mental Illness. And the first area was improve and expand discharge planning for prisoners with mental illness. The request and that between Representative Fran Bradley and Senator Berglund was to revise the definition of benefits or eligibility for individuals with mental illness that now are prisoners within our Department of Corrections. And they are also asking for those people that are in the DOC to have discharge planners making sure that individuals that have been placed in incarceration have been properly screened or re-evaluated to see if their purpose for there is due to mental illness and the like. And just to give you some background of where I'm coming from with this, I got involved with it. It goes back in my family many years. My wife has two brothers that have schizophrenia. Her mother, who's deceased, had schizophrenia, and her grandfather, who is deceased, had schizophrenia. And so it's a thing that gets passed down from generation to generation. And my 56-year-old brother-in-law, both of my brother-in-laws, the one's younger, he's 50, both spent 6 months in jail, the one due to mistaken identity, and that's the way law enforcement labeled it. He most likely was a suspect because of actions or demeanor in the way he acted on the streets, because he was homeless, and because of the way he performed in society. He would spend hours upon hours in the fast food restaurants. He loved to drink coffee, and I think he drank more sugar than he drank coffee. But when you talk to people who deal with people with mental illness, it's these kind of things that detect there is something imbalanced in their system. And he was always at the McDonald's or the Arby's or wherever. And people after a while kind of got leery of, who is this person? Why are they spending so much time there? And they would call the law enforcement, or they'd find out who it was, and they'd call my wife and say, could you come and pick up your brother? And it got to be so he ran away from us and headed for California, the warmer climes. Minnesota's not most ideally when you're a homeless person to live in this state. And so he lived from the hometown of where he went to college in Phoenix, Arizona, and traveled up into California, and he ended up in Bakersfield. And he's been there. He left in 1994, 1 month before his father passed away, and we could never find him to let him know that his dad had passed away. And it was just kind of sad that these people take off, and you can only hope that the good Lord is watching over them and taking care of them, because you never hear from them for months and months in time. Well, it was at a time when we had chosen to be very distant. It was at a time when he had chosen to be very distant from the family. There was no one to intervene on his behalf or on my brother-in-law's behalf, who was in Washington, D.C., and the family did not know where he was at all for months. Representative Griley and I want to make sure that the law helps families stay involved with treatment plans. When behaviors are extreme, there's every incentive to bail out, especially when the system emphasizes rights and privacies, making family input difficult. I just took my brother-in-law to a to Minnesota Central health entry exam, trying to get him help here in Wright County where we live. And I was going to walk in with him, and the person who was going to do the screening said, no, you're not allowed in here. Well, fortunately, my wife had the good sense to say the night before, Bill, would you be willing to sign up a mission, a consent form to allow me to come in and be able to talk on when the questions were asked of certain things? Because he had been to the doctor 2 weeks earlier, and the doctor had no knowledge because he wouldn't reveal anything about his past or that he everything was okay with him. He was at home. He was had his clothes washed. He had a meal on the table. And it didn't make any difference as to where his physical or his mental state was at that time. And so we were able to then come in and talk with the screener. Actually, it was a nurse, and then we went to see a doctor after that and to share with them. But the problem is when you get into the system of the DOC is when people are unjustly put into as prisoners and they have mental problems, and there's no one there to help them to get help. And so part of what Fran Bradley and Senator Berglund are trying to do is expand opportunities for prisoners who have mental illness. Some people say, well, these type of people can't work. They don't have the capability to work. But my brother-in-law wants to work. He wants to be out and be a part of society. He wants to share and give a part of himself to that situation. And so we're advocating from a family member, as Representative Greiling said, we have family members, and we're part of that family that have those individuals that are in our family that want to be a part of society, and yet because of their physical health and their mental state are just slightly left kind of out of the system. I know time's getting short here. I also wanted to touch on the fact that relating to work, our next meeting will be on February 28th from 5 to 6 p.m. right in this room here. And we have invited three groups, Tasks Unlimited, which Representative Greiling's son is working at and lives and stays there, RISE, and also a group out of Wright County called Functional Industries. That's where my daughter, who has cerebral palsy, is working, and that's where we're trying to get my brother-in-law in to get a working position there. And what's nice about Functional Industries, just as a comment, a brief side, they not only work with people in situations where their mental capacities are very limited, but if your mental capacity rises to a point where you look as normal as myself and my wife and everybody else, but yet you have some tendencies that kind of steer you away from that, they will put you out in the community. I know several people that are working at Culver's Restaurant, at Arby's Restaurant, at different places within Buffalo that are part of the Functional Industry Group have been brought there. My daughter was thought to be able to work as a receptionist in a big, nursery stock place, and they wanted her to be a receptionist, but handling 15 lines coming in. And she could handle the lines coming in, but then to transfer them to every one that was in the workplace, to remember where those numbers were and remember which button to hit, it was very hard for her. And for a week and a half, she tried. And they were willing to go as long as it took to get her help. And they finally, and what's nice about Functional Industry, they provide a worker to go with her. And my daughter and the worker decided that this was just going to be too difficult for her to handle. But they were looking for further opportunities within the workplace, within in the Buffalo or surrounding communities, if there was opportunities. And so we're hoping that the input that we have from these areas will give some enlightenment to legislators who are attending the Mental Health Caucus and can give you some hope to your constituents back home. If you have people who call and say, what do I do? How do I help these people? Where can I go? These might be some opportunities for you to plug into and get some more information and the like. And I'll turn it back over to Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. I also, in the introduction, I forgot to introduce, and I want to now, Sue Abderholden, if you could raise your hand or stand up or something. She is the Executive Director of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill of Minnesota, and she and also the group that's the Coalition of Mental Health Advocates are working with us to help us make sure we have good resource speakers and that we can get quick information, because we're having real fast meetings for most of us who are generalists in the area, other than what we've learned through our families. Also, I want to introduce Joe Zwack, who, if you could stand up. He's actually a constituent of mine, but he's also a past president of NAMI Minnesota and now co-chairs the NAMI Forensic Network. So that's people that end up in prison through their mental illness. So that was part of what we discussed at our last meeting. The last two meetings that we're going to have are on children's mental health issues. And this is one that this committee, even if you don't come to any other meeting, might want to come to. Because often we have, this is a controversial area of mental health, and so I think it will be a very interesting meeting. We have decided on the for the Mental Health Caucus that we're not a body at this organizational stage, or maybe never will be, a body that takes positions. We're a group of those of us who are interested in mental health, where we come to get facts and discuss pros and cons of things and kind of noodle issues. And so this one, this committee has heard bills from in the past. In the last legislative session, those of you who are incumbents and on this committee will recall, we passed legislation for teachers when they're getting their continuing education to have some recognition of children who are coming down with a mental illness, and so that they can notify the families who can follow up or not at their choice. And then we also heard legislation, or passed it as a legislature last year, that children who end up in the juvenile justice system or are exceptionally truant should be screened for a certain number of things, and one of them including mental illness, because that often goes hand in hand with kids going down the wrong path. We are now also, we haven't finalized which speakers we're bringing for the children's mental health meeting, which will be after the employment one, but there is a group, and that's the second handout that you got, that's working on integrated pathways for children's mental health in the schools, and Sue Abderholden is on that committee. You can see the list of others that are on there, including Department of Human Services, Hennepin County, some school representatives, and they're looking at how children's mental health intersects with the schools. And their goals, a couple of their goals I just want to highlight, and I would emphasize this is a draft. They haven't finalized their recommendations yet, and maybe at our meeting we could, you know, have some input into that if they're not done. They're stressing that they would like to have early identification, catching children before they get into special education. Special education is very expensive, and if you could get kids a little bit of help and they could avoid that, I think this committee could be very interested in that. They are, at least at this draft stage, recommending that schools not be involved in any costs with assessments or any psychiatric care. They should just be, you know, helping to notify families if they notice something, and then people can go to their own private insurance or the public system if they're poor people. That this helps kids to stay out of child protection, it prevents truancy, and so forth. And they said that what we passed last year is making a big difference. So I think those are important things. And again, I know that nationally, actually, not just in our state, what we do in the schools with children's mental health is very controversial. So I would urge us, you know, at a time when we can spend a whole hour, where we do have pizza, by the way, you can spend a whole hour listening to the back and forth of children's mental health issues. It would be a time that we probably can't spend this much time in this committee, but we really should. So I'd urge you, a lot of you, to come to that meeting when the time comes. And then the last meeting that we decided to have is going to, for this year, will be hearing a report from the, get this right, Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, which is a group that's been looking at an improved mental health system, and it's co-chaired by the Citizens League and our Commissioner Kevin Goodnow, our former colleague here in the House. And they have been working together with a large coalition of different viewpoints and advocates in the mental health system, and they're making recommendations. So we're hoping by our last meeting those will be finalized and we can hear those. And people on this committee, if there's any that involve children, we might want to pay attention to that as well. And finally, maybe you want to do the joining speech.
Well, we do encourage everyone to participate in this mental health caucus. We know that it doesn't apply just to the two representatives ourselves or the two senators that are involved, but as Mindy's already mentioned, is that we've got over half the legislature that has come and attended. Not everybody can come again, but at least they that first night was just overwhelming as far as the number of people that showed up. And so we would encourage, if you can make it, for February 28th, it's a Monday evening from 5 to 6 p.m. If you're interested, love to have you come and just participate. Again, we'll be talking about employment for those who are in need of that situation, especially those who are mentally challenged. And the concerns that we have are, you know, I think as Representative Dreiling's mentioned, I received a letter here from a lady from my school who is concerned about undiagnosed, misdiagnosed, untreated, or undertreated mental health problems, often complicated by the secondary level of chemical abuse. And you've heard about chemical abuse in your counties, your cities, and law enforcement is always after us to help in this area, because so many of our young people are getting involved with the chemical abuse, and yet when I talk to deputies, it's not only the young people, it gets to be even into the older generation. So we invite you to come, be a part of it, have some pizza and some pop, and just share in the camaraderie and hopefully learn a lot about what is going on in the mental health field. And we'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Members, we probably have time if for one question. Otherwise, we should move on to the next one. But I don't see any. Oh, I see one right now.
That's also the day of the education rally. I just wanted to point out that's going to be at the Capitol.
What time is that one?
I think it's at 5.
Right at 5.
Yeah.
Well,
I just wanted to tell you.
Thank you.
I think we've all learned that if we only have three conflicts, it's a good day.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Bradley.
I'm changing it to 5:30.
Okay.
But
thank you for putting that together and those meetings together. I think of it, more as a classroom teacher, and you always do. Want to know and try to learn what your students are dealing with in their own lives, but also what they're dealing with in their home lives. There's a lot of burden they carry. So from that point of view, I'm glad that I signed up myself for enjoying this caucus. We will move on. Thank you, Representative Anderson, Representative Greiling, to a report from the Early Childhood Caucus, and Representative Slowick is...
Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Welcome, Representative Slowick.
Good morning. Thank you. We're setting up our laptop so you can see the website. So I'll start while that's going on. What we have here today is the Early Childhood Caucus. There's a list of the members right here, so I want to thank the many of you that have joined the Early Childhood Caucus. I think it's really an exciting opportunity. We're actually in our third year, and I would have my co-chair here, who is Doug Meslow from the House, but obviously he is out this week with what's happened in his family, but I know he's fully supportive and appreciate the many of you that have joined. We come today, we appreciate you moving it a little bit behind because we have three working moms presenting today, so we all had childcare issues to get here. I'll be talking a little bit, and then we have Denise Myatt from the Sheltering Arms Foundation. Then we have Tracy Morgan, who is here with her daughter, Haley. She said, "Do I really have to come?" And I said, "I'd like you to come because you need to know who she is. She's the intern for the Early Childhood Caucus." To tell you a little bit about what we've been doing, as I mentioned, we're in our third year. Doug Meslow is the co-chair in the House. We have a new co-chair in the Senate, John Hottinger, who also chairs the Senate Early Childhood Committee, so we're pleased to have him on board. And then Claire Roebling is a Republican Republican senator who's organizing on behalf of the Republicans in the Senate. The idea of the Early Childhood Caucus came a couple of years ago when the Humphrey Institute was interested in organizing a women's caucus here at the legislature, and they had us down for meetings at the Humphrey Institute, and they talked to us about how they did it, and they brought in a representative from Illinois. And Illinois has done this, and the women formed a caucus, and their first vote they took was on child care and on increasing child care. So I thought, well, we didn't seem to be able to form a women's caucus for a variety of reasons, but maybe we could do it around a different notion. And that notion is the Early Childhood Caucus, to pull together members from the House, from the Senate, Republicans, Democrats, and work together on issue. The vision is that someday, maybe someday, we will take a vote together, we hope, but just yet we're still learning about the issue and trying to get up to speed on what's happening in terms of early childhood in our state. We also have pizza. I want you to know, if you want to know which came first, the Mental Health Caucus or the Early Childhood Caucus, we were actually hatched first, but it's very interesting to be moving forward together, and we're on the same kind of pizza and pop model, and works very well for members to stop by, and we're not sure if they come for the pizza or the learning, but either way, we're glad you're all there when you do stop by. We've had two meetings so far this year. Our first meeting was Rob Grunewald from the Federal Reserve Board came. You probably heard of his work with Art Rolnick. They wrote an initial paper about the returns on early childhood investment. Art Rolnick did the study about when states offer businesses subsidies to move from state to state, is it really economically viable and a good investment for states to be doing? And what he found is it's really not. When you look at Lockheed or even moving some of the software companies from Minneapolis to St. Paul, that it isn't necessarily the best investment. So Art Rolnick and Rob Grunewald looked at what is a good investment. When they looked at all the different things that the state could invest in, they found out that the highest rate of return actually is on kids and young kids. If you invest on young kids, particularly kids that are in impoverished areas or low-income areas, you can get a rate of return as high as 16%. Now, I don't know about you, but there's very few things that we invest in here or even in our personal lives that will offer that kind of a return on investment. Savings in special education, savings in remedial classes, savings in juvenile justice costs. So the bottom line is early childhood is a good investment. At our first meeting, Rob actually presented paper number 2, which they've come up with a viable way for the legislature to now put this theory into place, which is that potentially we could be investing in scholarships for low-income kids in these areas through a fund and then actually watch our rate on return. So it was a very interesting discussion. I will now turn it over to Tracy Morgan, who's going to show us the website. I realize I have my very entertaining screensaver up there, which you get to see of different scenes from Arizona. But Tracy has designed the website and been working with it, and we wanted to show it to you. We have 106 members who have joined, and it also has a report that Denise is going to be talking about. It shows all the bills that are in early childhood. And Tracy, do you want to talk about that more?
Mr. Chair, yeah. I'm Tracy Morgan, and I'm the intern for the Early Childhood Caucus. And this is the website that I've created as just kind of a place for central location for information regarding the caucus. Because there's a lot of information going back and forth between members, and so I thought it'd be a really great idea to have an electronic version where all members could go to access. And you can see the red right here. This is where we announce our upcoming Early Childhood Caucus meetings. And then I also put links to the agendas so you can see what we're going to be talking about. If you scroll down, you can see that I post summaries from past meetings. So if you're interested in finding out what we talked about, if you did happen to miss the meeting, you can look there. Or if you wanted to include it, I didn't mean to put that. If you wanted to, and this is an example of a past summary. So if you wanted to include it in any kind of literature you send back to your communities to show them what you've been involved in, that's a good way to do that. So I'm just going to go back to the website. There we go. Here in the pink box is the member list, and so you can click on that. Let's see if it works. Yep, it works. We have 106 members as of, the list was updated January 29th, 05. And so we have 106 members, which is well over half of both the Senate and the House. So that's wonderful, and we offer a hearty thanks to all those who are members of the caucus. But you can access this list anytime you want to see who's on there, and you can also refer your constituents to it. So let's see what else is important here.
You want to mention the address, Tracy?
Sure. The address, and that's also listed on the sheet that went out, the overview of the caucus. It's www.earlychildhoodcaucusminnesota, so MN.org. And please visit the site for any information you'd like regarding the caucus.
Thank you, and thank you for putting that together. Tracy is a doctoral student at the University of Minnesota, working in early childhood education. She's developing IGDs for occupational... for fine motor skills, and if you want to know what IGDs are, we can talk about that at another time, but they're indicators of progress. And I want to thank her for doing that, because having a website, one of the advantages, Representative Wardlow said to me, oh, I want to send out a summary or put it in my weekly newsletter. You can do that, and the things that you're writing back to your constituents, when people say, what are you doing down at the legislature? You could say, why don't you take a look at this? So this is one of the meetings that I've been attending. As you know, often it's hard for our constituents to get a sense of what we really do down here, and this is, I think, a very friendly version and way to do that. So thank you for putting that together. We'll talk to have Denise present here shortly, and then also I wanted to have Jim Dabney and Lynn Wardlow come up about the readathon as the last part. Denise Myatt is from the Sheltering Arms Foundation, and she came to my office about a year ago and said, you know, we're really interested in what's happening around young children in our state. What could we do to help? And as you know, you have, as a legislator, you have people that want to help you, and then there's people that really step forward. And I said, you know, one thing that would be really interesting is to take this out on the road and talk with legislators and have forums across the state. And she said, let me think about that and if we could do that. And I want to thank her and Sheltering Arms. They give a $5,000 grant to the Early Childhood Caucus, which allowed Karen Cadigan to take these forums. And she'll explain how many of there were and how they went. And I know that many of you attended those. I want to thank you for that. And I think our best quote, which was in here, is one legislator noted he had, quote, learned more about early childhood at the forum than in his 6 years in office. So that's the value of taking it on the road. And we hope to do more of that. The McKnight Foundation has also offered to have a half-day sort of retreat for us to talk about early childhood, as it's one of their big priorities. So hopefully all of you will think about attending that next summer. So Denise?
All right, thank you. And Ms. Myatt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to come and talk about these wonderful early childhood caucus community forums. And like Representative Slough said, I'm Denise Myatt, and I'm the executive director of the Sheltering Arms Foundation, which is a small foundation that funds programs for Minnesota's young children. And our trustees come from various Episcopalian congregations around the state, and recently decided that just making grants to nonprofits wasn't enough, that we really had a responsibility as members of the foundation community and as people of faith to try and lend our voice to policy discussions that affect the nonprofits that serve young children in the state. So last year, when we came and spoke with Representative Slowick about to see if there was something that we could do, she suggested that a bipartisan effort around the state with the Early Childhood Caucus to hold a series of forums, as she was describing, to provide ongoing education for not only legislators but also community members about issues of early childhood. In any case, we thought that that sounded like a good idea and decided that it would be a valuable way to move some of these conversations around early childhood forward. And I have to say that our trustees have been overwhelmed by the positive response to the forums. It's probably one of the best investments of what was really a very small amount of money that we've made in terms of the kind of feedback and just the value of the forums. And I know that some of the members of this committee present are also members of the Early Childhood Caucus, and that possibly some of you were present at one of the forums that were held this summer. And if that's the case, I want to thank you so much for taking your time and for coming forward to speak to audiences around the state. And I'm going to give a quick summary of what happened there. There's a longer summary that I have right here that is also listed on the website. So if you want to read more in depth, you can take a look at this. This was an excellent summary that was prepared by Karen Cadigan. If anyone would like to look at it, I've got it here. But these forums were held in 14 communities in all corners of the state, and they involved 28 different legislators and over 500 Minnesota citizens that came forward to speak and to listen at the forums. And around the state, members of the Early Childhood Caucus met with communities to talk about what's working for families with young children and, perhaps more importantly, what isn't working. And parents who participated in various programs such as ECFE, Head Start, child care providers, K-12 leaders, and many other people turned out for these events. And some came with concerns about cuts to early childhood education and their drastic effect on families. That was something that was heard a lot at these forums. And as Representative Slawik said, that legislators have very much appreciated the chance to be part of this, and she quoted the legislator that said that he'd learn more about early childhood at this forum than his 6 years in office, and that said a lot to us and to our trustees about the value of this program, and also as to why it might be valuable to repeat it next summer. And so we're looking into the possibility of doing that. We see the formation of this Early Childhood Caucus as a very positive sign. We're organizing around early childhood issues in the foundation sector as well. Minnesota foundations who are interested in early childhood issues have formed the Early Childhood Funders Network to educate ourselves on this issue and see if there's a way we can work together for the benefit of young kids. And as you've heard, the business community is coming together around this too. So there's a lot of energy and a lot of activity right now in the early childhood area. And I wanted to just mention one thing that's coming up that is an exciting opportunity. It's a conference that's going to be happening at the end of March called Seize the Opportunity, Invest in Early Childhood. Some of you may already have heard about this, but it's going to bring together over 600 business leaders, foundation representatives, policymakers, representatives from K-12 and higher education, advocates, community volunteers, and others to ensure that every child in Minnesota has an opportunity to enter kindergarten ready to learn. And there is going to be an event on the evening of March 21st for legislators, and I'd like to extend the invitation to you right now. You'll be hearing more formally about this, but this is an opportunity to come together with people from the other sectors who are going to be at the conference to hear about early childhood issues. Mm-hmm. And I've got a copy of the conference flyer right here, and if anybody would be interested in taking a look, I'd be glad to pass this around, but as I said, there'll be an opportunity, more formal invitation for you later on to hear about this conference. But it's going to be a very, very exciting event. I just want to close by thanking you for your support of actions on behalf of young kids in Minnesota. And like I said, it's such an exciting time, and there's so much energy in this area. I just wanted to mention one very promising activity that that we've been looking at, and many other foundations, and I know that you have been hearing about. It's the Minnesota Early Learning Fund that Representative Barb Sikora is going to be sponsoring to support the development
of a statewide early childhood system to make sure that all kids are ready for kindergarten. And this fund and other examples of public and private partnerships are definitely the kind of solutions that we need to look for during these times of high need and limited resources. We're proud to be a partner on behalf of young children, and we look forward to having continued conversations with all of you. So thank you for letting me say a few words here.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mayotte.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard we have 1 minute, so I'm going to ask Representative Dabney, Representative Wardlow, you have approximately 20 seconds each to make a statement. Mm-hmm. If you could talk about the readathon. One of the more visible things we do is the readathon and the rotunda.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will be the third year for the Early Childhood Readathon. It was one of the first big activities that the caucus took on. And it's an opportunity for legislators to work on a bipartisan basis and send a message about the importance of reading and reading in the early childhood framework. It's an opportunity for your constituents and early childhood providers to come to the Capitol and kind of bridge the gap between their days and our days, and it's just a fun event, and a number of you have participated last year thanks to the work of Karen Cadigan, in my poem pilot I just have her listed as the queen of the Early Childhood Caucus. We were able to, through the help of Learner Publications, a Mankato-based book publisher, I believe, yes, Representative Gordon?
Capstone Press.
Capstone Press, thank you. To give away 700 books to kids who came and to daycare centers who came. In addition, we had the bookmobiles from the Dakota County, Hennepin County, and Minneapolis libraries. We had library card giveaways. We had information on family literacy for the parents who came. We had Booker the library dog and Clifford the big red dog. It doesn't get much better than this. And we are hoping this year actually to expand to having two settings within the Capitol where legislators would have the opportunity to come and read books to little kids. As I said, it doesn't get much better than that. I'd like to welcome my co-chair this year, Representative Lynn Wardlow.
Representative Wardlow.
I'll just add my two cents. I offered to be the GOP co-chair of this committee, but Doug Messel, who is much more qualified than I anyway, beat me to it. So I was asked to help Representative Dabney with the readathon, and I'm happy to do that. And I just want to put forth that as members of this committee and the Education and Finance Committee, you're required to be a reader for that day. We'll just let you know ahead of time. That's our expectation.
I'll bring the sign-up sheet to committee and make sure we get on that. The Capstone Press you referenced is run by one of my high school classmates, but my daughter is also an editor there, so I know that company pretty well.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the readathon this year, we should say, is April 5th from 9 until noon, and we'll... Representative Wardlow and I will be getting out emails and scheduling people. We ask just for a 15-minute block of your time to come and read. And, you know, if you're not careful, Clifford will come over and pat you on the head, as he did a number of times with me last year.
All right.
I wonder why.
Thank you, all of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the
members.
The organization and the activity that you're doing. Last on the agenda, and we did need, we thought, at least a half hour for this part of the day's business, is a presentation by the Board of Teaching on teacher licensure, and we welcome Alan Hoffman to the committee and actually to your new role as the director of the Board of Teaching. And I should also add, members, small world category again, Mr. Hoffman and I shared a classroom this fall at Mankato East High School. His college class did a reading partnership with my high school, one of my high school classes. So we had the chance to work together this fall there, and now we're back in the same room wearing different hats. But welcome to the committee, Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you very much, Chair Dorn and members of the committee. I'll have to make sure that I refer to you as Chair Dorn instead of John, that I'm used to doing. I'll work hard on that, developing that new habit. We thank you very much for inviting us here today. My name is Alan Hoffman. As the chair mentioned, I've recently come to this job. I've just been here a little over a month. I bring with me 25 years of high school Spanish teaching and a couple of years as a faculty member at the College of Education. That's what I bring to the job. And with me is my colleague, Jan Kellner, for whom I'd really like to reserve the majority of the time. She's going to talk about something that is relatively new with the Board of Teaching in the department that has, I think, a lot of hope for dealing with some of the issues that we have to deal with. Just want to mention from the outset that as Aaron has responded to calls and Toby has helped us this morning, you have some very capable and competent people who make sure that people who come here feel welcome and know what they're doing, so we certainly appreciate their efforts. As soon as we get this ready, we're always waiting a little bit for technology. Just to let you know what, as I talked to Erin, she mentioned that you'd be interested in knowing about No Child Left Behind and compliance, and I have a few statistics about that. She also let me know that it would be good to talk about some of the issues that we're confronting now with teacher licensure and some of the issues that we've been working on that I have stepped into since my arrival. And then also she mentioned that there are some new members here, so I put together some data just on what some of the licensure, what it's all about. So I hope there's here something here for everyone, and we'll move through it fairly quickly, especially the first part, which is just kind of a primer on teacher licensure. We're close, I understand. I'll actually get started since you have your handouts. I can do this.
Okay, let's do that.
The types of licenses granted in the state of Minnesota have been constantly changing. Currently, we issue elementary K-6 licenses, and then those people also have to get a specialty area, 5-8 specialty area, which would be language, arts, social studies, science, or math, or a pre-K-6, so they come prepared to work in those settings. Secondary license would be a 512 in a specific content area, science, social studies. And then there are K-12 licenses issued in the areas of music, art, ELL, special ed, phi-ed, to mention a couple. And a piece of data that I'm sure you've heard before, about 96% of Minnesota teachers are licensed in the areas in which they teach, which stands very high in the, as we look across the nation. A couple of introductory numbers. And this is data based on a report that we put together for the 2003-2004 school year. Approximately 52,310 full-time equivalent teachers in the state of Minnesota, a total number of valid teaching licenses of 227,307. Of course, many people have a laundry list of teacher licenses. Total permissions, and this is the one that we really work hard at. These are people who are not fully licensed. There are 4,196 people currently, or as of last year in the state of Minnesota, who did not hold a valid teaching license for the area in which they were working. And the total permissions in core areas from the No Child Left Behind Act were 1,688, or about 40% of those permissions were in that area. Just a real quick move through what permissions are. We have four different permissions that we work with primarily. Waivers are permissions for teachers to teach outside their area in an experimental program. We see these most often in charter schools and ALCs. Variances, permission to teach in a related area in which a teacher is not currently licensed. Temporary limited, permission for a teacher who has not completed a teacher prep program but who has at least a bachelor's degree and is working toward licensure. And then the non-licensed community expert is for a person who does not hold a valid license to present material for which a district has not been able to find an appropriately licensed teacher. The next two pages are simply some numbers where the permissions lie in the core areas, and I certainly won't read through those for you, and I apologize that all the numbers are not lined up. Once upon a time they were, and then I hit some key and away they moved, but I think you'll be able to see how they operate. But you can see the non-licensed community expert, waiver, variance, and temporary limited numbers in the core areas for 2003-2004. If you go to the next page, I have the same thing tabulated. This is for the current school year, and what you need to know are a couple of bits of information. One that I just recently discovered, that the new authorization of IDEA is now going to ask us to look at special education teachers as well in the core area, and we have not Haitian teachers as well in the core area, and we have not included those in this data, so that will change that significantly. The other thing is that these numbers are as of the day before yesterday.
The report is not completed. We have probably about two-thirds, 65 to 70% of the districts have reported in, so these numbers are not complete, and they're probably on track to meet about what was present last year as well. Moving on to the next one, the areas of concern for licensure. As most of you know, No Child Left Behind, the highly qualified requirement. House is in place, and of course is for teachers to meet the highly qualified mandate of No Child Left Behind if they are not in their license area. And currently in Minnesota, this does not lead to licensure. It qualifies them to be highly qualified, but is not a teaching license. The non-renewable license, which we have been working on, is currently in the rulemaking process. Will allow a teacher to meet the definition of highly qualified while still under a variance, somebody who is seeking full licensure. And at the current time, the language will give these people 3 years to complete a program to become fully licensed. One of the areas on the next page that we've been working on, I shouldn't say we because I wasn't involved in this when I was a board member, but people have been working on for a long time, is the area of science, and you hear about that as an area of concern quite often. There have been over 2 years of meetings, there have been deadlock meetings, there have been people who can't agree, some very wise people representing a lot of different positions, but as of the meeting in February, the board meeting, we will be presenting a resolution to the board next month to move ahead to create a 912 general science license. And you have to believe me that this represents a lot of compromise from a lot of folks to get to the position of actually moving forward with this. And that, of course, will need to go through the rulemaking process, and you folks know better than I do the how that works. The other one that I believe will resurface, and I hearken you back to your conversation at the beginning of the day on the Avalon Charter School, there are a lot of people out there in the state of Minnesota, and of course we are a leader in charter schools, who are looking at the area of licensure and saying we probably need something different for all of the people who are being educated in alternative fashion between ALCs and charter schools. I hear that somewhere around 20% of the student population in Minnesota is being educated in some alternative fashion, and the current license structure is not always working. The teacher of record model is being used currently, but these people are saying there are different ways to go about educating students in charter schools and ALCs. Is there not a license that could be developed that would allow these people to do that and to be highly qualified and to know more about this type of education? There was a year worth of meetings, and really nothing came out of that. People could not agree. However, I understand that there is some proposed legislation to ask the board to rethink this. And I just, as a personal comment, I look at the science license where for 2+ years people could not agree, and now we're in a position where there is some agreement. I wonder if this might not happen in the interdisciplinary license issue as well. I don't know for sure. I'm just speaking from a speculation that as we move down the road and know more about kids and how they learn and revisit things, many times ideas change as people become more educated. So that one, I believe, we're going to be revisiting.
Representative Biskins, a question to this area?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hoffman, that second bullet, proposed legislation, where is that coming from? Is the department proposing this legislation?
You know, I'm really not sure. I just saw a piece of legislation that I was asked to comment on from our legislative representative at the department, and it has a House file, and I'm not really sure who proposed it.
All right. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I see people from the department who are shaking their head no, that they're not proposing legislation along this line. So
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. The paraprofessional rule, which the board was mandated to develop a credential 2 years ago, is still in the rulemaking process. We're in the process of making revisions based on some changes that have taken place over the last 2 years and its development, and it turned into something which I think a lot of people didn't envision it would turn into, and we are still working on that in collaboration with the Department of Education to make that something workable and usable in the schools. Alternative pathway is another area that we have heard an awful lot about over the last couple of years. The current statute was created in the early 1990s.
many people are looking at it and saying it is not necessarily workable some years later. And a work group has been meeting and will continue to meet on a revision to this. We've been in the process of looking at this for many months. A decision by the board in February to move forward with a revised statute based on some of the new realities of today that weren't present in the early 90s, to incorporate suggestions of the Department of Education and other constituent groups, and we will be meeting next week with that to try to bring together a compromise on what that legislation might look like. And it will contain many of the key components that we know of successful alternative programs. The idea on the next page that I really want to spend a little bit more time talking about, and I'll refer to my colleague Jan Kellner, is licensure via portfolio. This is something that was relatively recently launched by the Department of Education in collaboration with the Board of Teaching. It's been in place since about fall, and it is an opportunity for somebody to come in and actually receive a full-fledged teaching license by demonstrating that they have met the competencies required in the state of Minnesota by developing a portfolio. And what it amounts to is an assessment of what a person will submit their request. They will be told what they need to do in order to meet the competencies. They will develop a portfolio to show evidence that they have, and then that will be assessed by professionals and could ultimately lead to licensure. And I'm going to ask my colleague Jan Kellner to talk about that. She was instrumental in working on that program and knows the insides and outs of it, and she will do a much better job in talking about it than I will. So, Jan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for asking us to come and share information concerning licensure via portfolio. We're very excited about the process, and we've had a lot of interest, and we're excited about the possibilities that this process holds. Licensure via portfolio was authorized, created based on the authorization of Minnesota Rule 8700.7620 Teacher Licensure Candidate Assessment Alternative. And I'd like to direct your attention to the screens or the handouts that you have in front of you. The process is a standards-based process where you meet the standards of professional knowledge and subject matter identified by the Board of Teaching Rules. And those rules would be 8710.2000, the Minnesota Standards of Effective Practice for Teachers, and 8710.3000 through 8080, specific subject matter standards. A description of a portfolio can be described in several different ways. I've brought three with to share with you today. The first, a thoughtfully designed presentation of documents evidencing how an applicant meets the knowledge, skills, and competencies required for licensure. The second, a comprehensive selection of documents that provides evidence demonstrating how the applicant meets all required licensure standards. And finally, presents evidence of quality of experiences that align to the specific standards. Through these three descriptions, there are three strands that ensure the quality and high standards we're looking for in our teachers in Minnesota. The first one would be evidence. Documents evidence. Evidence demonstrating. Presents evidence. The second strand would be thoughtfully designed, comprehensive selection, quality of experiences. We're looking for very thoughtfully selected and carefully designed examples of experiences that demonstrate quality. And finally, the third strand, applicant meets competencies, meets all required standards, and aligns to specific standards. All the standards must be demonstrated. The portfolio process is not, it's not a shortcut. It's not a shortcut to professional state license. And it's not a scrapbook of one's experiences. It's a carefully designed collection of evidence that demonstrates competency, skills, and knowledge in all of the required standards. The portfolio process serves two purposes. The first is for the individual applicant. It provides a process to assess knowledge, skills, and competencies of individuals seeking a license who have not completed an approved teacher preparation program in Minnesota. The second, for individuals who believe that they have all of the qualifications necessary to meet standards. We also have a disclaimer right away with the applicants. Although this will meet the requirements for licensure in Minnesota, it may not be recognized by other states. And we want anybody who is going through this process to be aware of that right up front. Who's eligible for licensure via portfolio? We have two groups of individuals. The first group would be individuals holding a current 5-year teaching license in any field. Mr. Hoffman just shared with you all of the different permissions the Board of Teaching offers for teachers to teach outside of their field. Many teachers who hold special permissions are taking advantage of the licensure via portfolio to become licensed in the area that they're teaching now outside of their field. The second group of individuals would be individuals with a minimum of a baccalaureate degree in a field other than education with teaching or related experiences. I have an example of an individual right now who was an industrial engineer, specifically a nuclear engineer, who is making a career change into education, and he's working on developing a portfolio for physics and the standards of effective practice. No matter who the applicant is, they must be able to demonstrate sufficient teaching and preparation experiences to meet the Board of Teaching standards. Acceptable evidence. Applicants may demonstrate their knowledge, skills, and competencies through academic preparation, which would be college, universities, postgraduate courses, may be used as evidence, professional development, workshops, trainings, conference experiences, teaching or related experiences, and other professional activities such as maybe publications, awards, any of those pieces of evidence could be used to demonstrate competency. An overview of the process. This will be kind of a quick overview of the process. There's 5 steps. The first one is to determine eligibility. And when you're determining eligibility, we ask that you do a transcript analysis if you have, first of all, completed a regionally accredited or state-approved teacher preparation program outside of Minnesota. Second, a teacher preparation outside of the United States. And third, an alternative preparation program outside of Minnesota. Many of the individuals that have had training in these various methods are already meet the standards for licensure, and they do not need to go through the portfolio process. They just need to have their information analyzed. The process is not for individuals who do not hold a baccalaureate degree, that's a minimum requirement, or for those currently enrolled or partially completed a teacher preparation program. We're not trying to be a substitute for higher education. Second, the second step is to submit a notice of intent. And I have a timeline, and the timeline shows the date the portfolio is submitted. 30 days prior to that date, the applicant needs to submit a notice of intent, which allows us time to find reviewers that will be qualified to do the review of that individual's portfolio. Steps 3 through 5. Step 3 is to submit 2 copies of the portfolio. Step 4, the Board of Teaching and the Minnesota Department of Education reviews the portfolio. And finally, step 5, recommendation and report. Steps 3 through 5, and if you go back to your timeline, may take up to anywhere from 10 to 90 days. We have had a 3-day turnaround time and a resubmit of portfolio, but most of them right now are currently, the reviews are running 10 to 15 days. At that point, if the report from the reviewer comes back where all the standards have been met, the process ends, and that person is recommended for license, and they go through the application process that any other applicant for a teaching license in Minnesota would do. If the report comes back and some of the standards have not been met, they're given a second chance. They have a year from the date of submission to resubmit materials. We recommend that they do that as quickly as possible, but we're allowing up to a year in case some of the applicants feel necessary to return to coursework. We're trying to allow them time so that they'll be able to demonstrate competency in those standards. Okay, final recommendation, if it's approved. If the portfolio demonstrates all the competencies, the applicant moves through the licensure process. Again, if not, they're given a second chance, and they may resubmit materials. Okay, to date, we have had 28 portfolios submitted, 7 in the area of adult basic education, 2 in communication arts and literature, 4 in dance and theater arts, 2 in music, 1 in visual arts, 2 in science, 1 in Spanish, 1 in early childhood education, and 8 in the standards of effective practice. Approved. Of all the portfolios submitted, 5 have been approved in adult basic education, and I'll let you read the rest of the chart. Together, the Minnesota Board of Teaching and the Educator Licensing and Teacher Quality Division of the Department of Education are providing a service, an alternative pathway to licensure, and it's based on current licensure standards and procedures. We have just recently, in November, launched all of our information on a website. On that website, we have the guidelines, forms, the evidence of competency grids, and soon to be added will be examples of portfolios. And we'd be glad to answer any questions you may have concerning this process.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kellner. And members, are there any questions? Representative Carlson.
I'm interested in how deeply you check on the information that's been submitted assure that somebody isn't enhancing their experiences beyond what they realistically work.
We have included in our guidelines an affidavit of authenticity that needs to be signed by the individual submitting the portfolio, and that has to be notarized.
Representative Carlson?
Chairman, I'm not sure then if that answers the question. That's notarized. That simply says that the person submitting it is providing the affidavit. But do you check beyond that?
Yes, we do. We use the official transcripts. All of the official transcripts must be accompanied by course syllabuses. All of that information is highlighted and related directly back to the standard that it is evidence. The same thing is true for professional development activities, teaching experiences, other related activities, and publications. Does that answer your question?
Representative Carlson.
I think it helps. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Heidgergen.
Thank you, Chair Dorn. I have a question perhaps for the Chair. Representative Biskins may be best, might best answer this. Who actually has the final say as to what the standards are going to be in regards to coursework required, say if you want to have an English major? Who determines what courses are to be taken? Is that under the jurisdiction of the legislature, or is that under jurisdiction of the colleges?
Mr. Representative Biskins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, while I appreciate Representative Heidgerkin's confidence in me, I think the gentleman who is best able to answer that question is sitting at the table.
Mr. Hoffman.
My understanding would be that it's ultimately the standards that have been promulgated by the Board of Teaching that have to be met. And then the preparation institutions will develop their coursework to ensure that those standards are being met. Is that
follow up? Do we have? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have? Does the legislature have a say in what is to be offered and what is not to be offered?
Mr. Hoffman.
in terms of a given teacher preparation?
In case of, I would like to re-examine what your course requirements are in a lot of fields, because looking at my sons and daughters have gone through college, I see no relativity to some of the courses that are being required in their fields.
In teacher preparation?
Especially, yes.
Okay. Once again, I guess all I can say is that particular preparation institution knows that they have to provide evidence that their students have met the standards that are required by the Board of Teaching. And those standards are many times not explicit, but rather embedded in the coursework.
Representative Heidegger. In other words, then, you do have the board has the final say and not the legislature.
The Board of Teaching does assessments of approval programs of all of the teacher preparation institutions and make sure that they have provided evidence that they're meeting the standards, and that's done on every few years. Yes.
I still don't understand exactly who has the final say as to what the required coursework are going to be for certain fields.
Okay, Representative Biskins to this point.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Heidegger, and it's my understanding that statutory law always overrides rules. So if the legislature wanted to dabble into the minutiae of the courses offered at colleges, it's certainly within our prerogative to do so. All right. At this point, we have not.
Okay, very interesting, and I think that's something we should pursue.
Thank you. Representative Wardlow, also to this point?
Related, not this.
Okay, then I'll go to Representative Demmer next on the list, and then Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to get back to my train. We were helping Representative Heidberg, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We all need to.
And we're not done. Mr. Chair and folks, in the alternative licensure being portfolio, the one thing I'm curious about, I think this is good. I think we're getting, we're going a good direction here. One thing that dawned on me, there wasn't a lot of discussion about how these people getting licensed this way get along with kids. And I'm wondering the component of teaching experience is talked about in here and how they interact with kids. Is there something in here that is also looked at, utilized, taken into consideration when they're looking at being licensed in this method?
Ms. Kellner, want to try that one?
Yes, that would be addressed in the standards of effective practice. The teachers will have to demonstrate through their teaching experiences, and that might be through actual activities with students, actual things that they've developed for students. It might be through performance evaluations, how they interact with the students, and that is specific in the standards of effective practice.
So, Ms. Kellner, to follow up a bit then, for example, the nuclear engineer that you referenced that is seeking a second career, part of that person's portfolio then would most likely include an actual teaching experience? Is this someone who would have been teaching under some sort of waiver or that, so that there was actual classroom experiences oftentimes that are part of these portfolios?
Yes, that's one of the prerequisites, that they do have teaching or related experiences. Sometimes they'll come from the private sector. Sometimes it may be someone who's teaching on a community expert permission. Or they may just have various types of teaching experiences in various situations.
Would that teaching experience be in the K-12 level for which they're being licensed? And I myself taught some college before I went back and became licensed in secondary, and discovered later that the college preparation wasn't that applicable to what I dealt with as a high school teacher. It didn't count for much in terms of what I needed to learn, but this would be on that level.
Yes, that's okay. A very good question. Okay. They must demonstrate that they have teaching experience with the age level they're applying for a license for.
Thank you. Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having taught middle schoolers, 7th and 8th graders, I don't think there's anything that can prepare you for everything you're going to run into. But I was curious, maybe under this new portfolio system being recommended or the old one, What about I know that teachers who are retired and let their license lapse can get the 1 year deal for if you don't sub for more. You can sub for 15 days or less. But how difficult would it be for a retired teacher to get his or her 5 year teaching license back if they so desired?
We'd miss you if you went back.
Yeah. I'm not saying I'm going to. I'm not a masochist sometimes. I know.
There's Kellner.
The portfolio process would be available. However, I believe there are other means in place for that individual to obtain their license, to have it reinstated.
Representative Wardlaw.
But I don't want to go back to school. Yeah.
If you don't want to go back to school, if your license is just expired, I believe there is a system in place where you'll be able just through continuing education, the renewal, continuing education renewal committee in the school that you previously worked in, where that will.
I know. I'm just looking for Mr. Chair.
I was in Wardlaw.
I'm just looking for a shortcut.
It raises another question because related experience. I think this in part this experience of the legislature can qualify for some of those continuing ed units, and there probably is some overlap we won't go into. What about the related, Ms. Kellner, what about in terms of the portfolio, what types of related experiences can qualify? I've lost track of the bullet. I think it said teaching or related experiences. What kind of related experiences would qualify or have qualified for some of those who have gone through this process?
Many of their professional experiences from their career in their content area would apply. And so we look at anything that the applicant will submit, and the guide that we give to the applicant is to make sure that any experience that they're submitting directly relates to and demonstrates the standard. That's their guide.
Okay, and I think the last question on the list, and we're running short of time, is Representative Biskins.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any other questions? We will, Representative Peterson, take that last question slot.
Chairperson Dorn, I'm curious as to who makes the decisions. Do you have a panel of teachers? Who makes the final decisions about the acceptance of the portfolio?
Ms. Kellner.
That's a good question. We do have reviewers, and our reviewers are experts in the area. They're practicing teachers who are licensed in that area at the age level that applicant is applying for a license. They do the review, then that's reviewed by staff at the Department of Education, and then the recommendation moves on to both the Executive Director of the Board of Teaching and the Director of Education for Licensing and Teacher Quality for final recommendation.
Thank you. I see no further questions, and we're at the 10 o'clock hour. Thanks to all the presenters today, and the meeting is adjourned. Okay.